Welcome to my podcast, Sounding Off with Kim Munson. I'm thrilled to have on the line with me a patriotic historian as well as former Army Ranger Ben Martin. He was our guest just recently on the show, and we were talking about the important documents and speeches of America's founding. And we actually ran out of time. There is so much to talk about there. And we had run out of time. And so we wanted to go ahead and continue the conversation. We thought this podcast was a great place to do that. So, Ben Martin, welcome to Sounding Off with Kim Munson.
Well, thank you, Kim. So great to be here with you today. It feels like a Saturday almost, you know. But I'm happy to be here and happy to continue on with this really important part of our American founding heritage. And if I could, before we start, I just wanted to say I'd like to put a quick overview on what the objective is covering this period of the pre-Revolutionary War and the three founders that we're going to speak about today. And this period is not often studied well, and these founders are not well known. But studying the creation of the Declaration, the War, the Constitution, Washington and Franklin and guys like that, are more interesting to most of the casual American people. But I must say that without the efforts of these three founders, the evils that they recognized and broadcast to their fellow British citizens in America, and then effectually organized them and led them to offer resistance, effectual resistance to the British government and their officials over in America. Without all of them and what they did, we may not have had the Declaration, the Revolutionary War, our Constitution, or our Republican government today. We just might not be here today. So it's important that we understand what they did and who they were. And so that was the main purpose of taking this period and these people and focusing on them.
Well, and go to my website, that is kimmunson.com, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. And the show that Ben is talking about is the May 19th show where we started this conversation. So who are these three founders that we are talking about both during this last show and on this podcast, Ben Martin?
Oh, yes, great. So the first one of these was a guy named James Otis Jr., and he was from Massachusetts, and he actually was not from Boston, but he moved to Boston to practice law, and that's where, of course, he became famous, out of the country. Just like John Adams, the same kind of guys, they move out of the country, come into the city, and they make a name for themselves. So he was the first guy, and he was the one that way back in the 1750s and the 1760s, although he was a British citizen, he started recognizing that after the war, the French and Indian War, and the British needed that revenue, they started doing things that were against our rights as British citizens over here in America and against the British Constitution. Although it was not written, and still is not written, it was against what they had established as the British Constitution and the laws under it, which all come from Parliament and really not from the Constitution. So he was the guy that first brought this out, and he was the guy that was focused. He's the guy that changed from being a Tory, a loyalist to the British, to becoming an American patriot, and it did it right in everybody's eyes. Now, he was younger than our friend and better-known patriot, Samuel Adams, who is considered the founding father of the Revolutionary War. But, as we talked about before, Samuel Adams was not very focused when he got out of Harvard. He graduated Harvard 3 years earlier than our good buddy James Otis. But he didn't start really focused on work. His father set him up in business, and he failed at the businesses that he set him up in. And he kept turning back towards political activism, which was what was his big strength. But he needed somebody like Otis, who was organized and knew the law and was, I guess you would say, more responsible at the time, to get him focused and to move him along. And so Otis's span of political activism was short because he had these problems with mental illness, and then they were exaggerated by an attack upon his head late in the 1760s, which caused him to be ineffectual after that. But he had spent enough time working with Sam Adams so that Sam Adams could carry on his work well into the end of the century. And so he is the guy that's the long-lived person here that did all of the work. And this should be more concentrated about him. And then finally, Patrick Henry, that came from Virginia. So the people from the Boston area, Massachusetts area, and Virginia, those were the two hot spots that created this fervor for revolution, for resistance to the British. And so they represent those two areas, and they actually worked together in some of these things, and they became that. But again, Patrick Henry, his tenure didn't last as long as Sam Adams. So we want to talk about those three people and what they did today and what the results of what they did led, you know, have given us today. And one of the first things that we want to talk about, again, was that, and it's so important. I mean, last night I was listening to a broadcast on TV talking again about the violations of the Fourth Amendment and all of these investigations that are being conducted right now that had been being conducted all during the Obama administration, you know, without due process of law, without due justification for searching into people's backgrounds and quote-unquote spying on them. So it's very relevant today that we look at this, the same kind of issues today that we're looking at, that they were looking back at over 200 years ago.
Well, it is. And the Fourth Amendment is really the one that was James Otis. It was so important to him because the Brits were coming in and just going through people's homes and going through their papers.
Right.
And he realized that that was really antithetical to a liberty loving people. And
That's exactly right. He was instrumental
in the Fourth Amendment. And we are seeing the Fourth Amendment stomped all over when we're looking at this contact tracing with this COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption. And we are seeing all kinds of bureaucrats and politicians that are using this COVID-19 thing to throw out the Fourth Amendment. And it was very timely then, and it's very timely now. Now, we really went through James Otis. Can I just say one thing?
What you're saying?
Sure.
You're talking about them using that or misusing it during a time of crisis. And that's the same thing that was happening back then. The British needed money. They needed revenue. They needed control. They needed to tell the American people what to do, just like many of our mayors and governors are doing today. And he was one of the first people with a legal background and the effectiveness to stand up and tell the people and to tell the people we have to come together to resist this. They're taken away. And if we don't stop it now, we're going to become the British slaves and not British citizens. And so you had to organize the folks, just like what you and other folks are doing today, to try to organize people to recognize our rights are being violated. And if we don't stop it now, what's next? So that it's also important, and it keeps on going. This is so many of our founders said over and over again, our rights have to be defended over and over and over again. You just can't rest on laurels here.
Well, and we are seeing with this crisis that these bureaucrats, these unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats, are putting out edicts that are closing down businesses, not letting us assemble, which, you know, that the your pursuit of your life, your liberty, and your happiness is inherent in the American idea, and it's embodied in the Declaration. Of course, the Constitution then is put in place to try to protect that vision. And we're seeing unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats making or having edicts that go against people being able to do that. And then, of course, these executive orders from many of these different governors. It's just astounding what's going on. And that's why we need to engage in this battle of ideas. So what we'll do, Ben, is refer people back to our May 19th broadcast, which is on the website. The recap is there. And we really went through James Otis, and we'd started with Samuel Adams. And you said there's so much to talk about with Samuel Adams. So let's continue that discussion about Samuel Adams.
That's a really good point, Kim, that we'll do that, because what in the first part of this, of that 10-year decade of the 1760s, they worked very closely together on these different issues. And that was so important for the longevity for our country, of course, and our country's prospects and our country's future. But it worked. It was so well that they that James Otis trained Samuel Adams and had him focus and become really disciplined, so that he was even a much more effective political leader, and so that he could carry on this work throughout the remaining part of that century of the 18th century. So and brought great things to us, and so we talk about that, and we talk about what were the things that they worked on together? What were the things that they did? And then we start talking about the British putting together what we talk about, what our founders talked about in our Declaration, that long train of abuses and usurpations. And that was the start of those things, when they started deciding they were going to tax us for all these different things that they didn't, you know. They went back, especially James Otis, went back all the way back to the Magna Carta and said, you did that there. The English did that there and said, you can no longer tax people. This was the barons they were talking about then, not just ordinary people, but you can't tax them without their being represented and without them consenting to the taxes. And, you know, that's kind of the basis of what this all is about. You know, our government that we have today is based upon the consent of the people. And no just law can be enacted under the principles of our Declaration without there being consent of the people. And that is what's being stepped all over today. And that was the same thing that was being stepped on back then.
Let me just draw a correlation very quickly. In Colorado, we have, it's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution. It's called TABOR. It's the Colorado Taxpayers Bill of Rights. Right. And basically it says, hey, PBIs, politicians, bureaucrats, and interested parties, if you want to raise our taxes, you just need to have the good manners to ask us. But then what has happened is these PBIs have then just redefined a word. It has the same effect of taking money out of people's pockets, but they call it a fee because they don't want to have to ask us. And now what's going to happen this next election cycle? Governor Polis has just issued an executive order which will be relaxing the requirements, the things that people had to do to get an initiative, a citizens' initiative, on the ballot. Now, for the due date too late initiative, he is making them jump through all kinds of hoops to have signatures, written signatures on hard copy petitions, having those notarized. But moving forward, he is saying that that people can actually sign this via email or via mail-in ballot. So he's circumventing this government of the people, by the people, with this new edict. So what happened back then is actually happening right now, Ben Martin.
Exactly. And it just repeats itself. And if people like you, you know, can tell other folks, like you have been doing, that's what happens. That's why you need to go back and learn history, because it just comes back again and again and again. It's the cycle of human nature. And we have to be on guard all the time for that. That's just ever vigilant. You know, we have to do it because people do that. People, as our founders pointed out way back when, they are motivated by the evils of ambition and avarice over and over again. And it's up to us to learn to control those emotions, those passions. And you know, they always said, our founders, when they were writing the Federalist Papers, they said that the emotions, the passions, must be controlled by the government, but the government must be controlled by the people. So it's this, I don't call it a vicious cycle, but I call it a self-correcting cycle. And we have to do this. We have to have people like you. We have to have people like Otis that recognize the real dangers of what is happening, even if it's a little thing, and resist it, because little things, you know, it's like the crack in the dike, you know, or the hole in the dike. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just let it alone, it eventually destroys the dike and becomes a flood, and we have to start all over again building the dike. And we don't want to do that. We don't want to have our Constitution destroyed, because it's the greatest form of government the world has ever known. So when we talk about that, we talk about how the, you know, Adam started his political career after being inspired. Both Adams, as John Adams and his brother Samuel, or his cousin Samuel Adams, both were inspired by this great passionate speech that James Otis gave in February of 1761. He was a general advocate. It was a British position. It was a high British position in the Superior Court there in Massachusetts at the time, and he was the guy. And when he realized that he was going to have to argue the government's point against the people on these writs of assistance, these open-ended search warrants without any specification, he resigned his high position and made mention, not made mention, he broadcast to the people that I am resigning my position and I am going to represent the rights of the people without any fee, pro bono. And so then he came in to that high court where he used to be the advocate general, and he had to argue from the defense side. And that changed him. That's what John Adams said at that time. He saw him change from a British Tory citizen to an American patriot. And everybody else saw it too. And so he was almost immediately elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives there, and he became one of those people that everybody looked to for leadership. And so he established his credibility in a very public venue. And he organized and led resistance against every British act in that long train of abuses and usurpation. And as I said, he brought Sam Adams in there. And to name just a few, and I know you know a lot of these that we discussed a long time ago back in the classes that we were going through together. The Sugar Act was the first one that they came out. Was the first one that they taxed us in 64. Then the Stamp Act in 1765. And then this goes to what you were just talking about before with the Tabor. The Declaratory Act of 1776 and the Townshend Acts of 1766 and 1767. These acts said they took away taxes because of the resistance and the effectual organized resistance of Otis and Adams. And they said, okay, we're taking those back because we see they're really making you angry and you're focused on your attention. But we're going to leave this little tax in here. It's called a tea tax. We've taken all those other taxes out. But we're just doing that to prove that we have the authority to tax you. And it's going to be a really small tax, so you won't even notice it, and it's not even worth your efforts to resist it. But resist it they did, because they knew that's the little camel's nose under the tent, and they have to resist it. So they went through all this, Adams along with Otis, and then it eventually led to this wonderful letter, in 1768, a Massachusetts circular letter, again, that they co-authored, but really most of it was the authorship of Otis, but Otis and Adams co-authored it, and that's why Adams got to be such a good writer too, because of the lessons that he learned from Otis. And this letter was a great letter, and it was an organizing letter to bring all of the other townships and the counties in Massachusetts, and then the other colonies around Massachusetts together to resist what the British were doing. And they did this circular, and then they wrote another letter. Those two guys wrote another letter to the British king and to the Parliament. It was really amazing, and they said they listed all these grievances, and they said, you know, we've got all these other colonists that are supporting us in our effort here too, in our resistance. And so then the Massachusetts British governor said, you can't send that. And they were sending it as the legislative body of Massachusetts, and the governor said, you can't do it. And so Otis organized a vote in the Massachusetts legislature that was overwhelming, not something like 92 to 17 or something like that, and said, yes, we can send it. And, oh, by the way, not only am I sending that letter to, but he said, I'm adding a letter saying that I believe that you, King, should replace the governor. Oh. And they sent that letter, you know, I mean, and that was it. And it kind of quietened things down a little bit until the British governor at the time, he sent his own letter to the king and said, we need the support of the army here because we can't control these crazy British citizens in Massachusetts, in Boston. These New Englanders, they're wild. And so that's when they put troops into Boston to occupy, and that's when the Quartering Act and all of that stuff was starting. The Quartering Act wasn't so bad then. It was public buildings and stuff like that, and barns and stuff where the British troops could be housed. They couldn't be housed anywhere they wanted to. That would come later with the coercive, or what the Americans call the Intolerable Acts of 1774. So that led to the Boston Massacre because the troops that were occupying it were not very civil to the citizens of Boston, as you can imagine. They didn't like, the British soldiers didn't like being over there, and of course the British citizens of Boston didn't like them being there either. And so one of the things that Otis and Adams did was they kind of started this own little newspaper, and they wrote these articles every day. And I'm not sure how many of them were true, but they would chronicle abuses of the British citizens by the occupying army. And of course, that got everybody stirred up. And before long, they had the Boston Massacre, where the British soldiers were surrounded by the Boston citizens, and they fired into them feeling threatened. And then we had people killed, and the British soldiers and the British officials thought that they would be executed, but they showed them Adams, John Adams, Sam Adams, showed them that they would give them a fair trial. And the majority of them were exonerated from what they did because they were following orders and all of the confusion. And two of them were given manslaughter charges that were reduced so that where their hands only got branded, and that was all. So they showed that they could be the citizens of Boston and Massachusetts, the people that were patriots, could show that they were reasonable and they were responsible people, and they could administer justice to people even though they had everything on their side. They could have been less than just with them. And so that really showed something there. But then they went from there, and then they had this little quiet period. Then that's when in 1772 Adams started organizing the committees of correspondence, and they started connecting all of the the colonies together. And the first two that really connected well were the colonies of Massachusetts and the colonies of Virginia, because they were facing some of the same things. Then, and that was good that they started doing it in 72, they started recognizing it, because then in 73, they had the Tea Party. They had that tea tax, and they were forcing the Americans to buy only tea from the East India, the British East India Company. And you talk about shutting down trade, just like in New York, they did. They shut down trade in the port of Boston first, and then they shut down trade in New York, Charleston, and Philadelphia. And so all of these things were shut down, and the business people, the British citizens that were in American colonies, and they were patriots, they could not open their businesses. They could not earn a living unless they agreed to buy this tea. Now, the tea was actually cheaper than the regular tea that the Americans could either smuggle or buy on the open market. But it was the fact that they were being forced to buy that tea, and that part of that tea was that they had to buy was a tax back to the British. And so it was the principle of things that went about. And so when they had the Tea Party and they threw all the tea into the ocean or into the bay there in Boston and sent the ships back to England, that is when the British came up with these coercive acts, and they were very coercive, and they shut down the ports, they shut down the administrative, they shut down the legislatures in Boston, and then next in Virginia. So you could see that what they were going through there in Boston was now being applied to the people in Wilmington in Virginia itself, you know. So both of their legislatures were shut down, and then other legislatures were shut down too. So they couldn't even do the things they were doing, and it all started with, like what you're saying about changing the name, changing a definition from a tax to a fee or whatever. It was the same thing. Well, we're going to withdraw all of these big taxes, but we're going to leave a little tax in there to show you that we have the right to do it. And if they hadn't resisted, things may have been different for them and for us today. So talks a little bit about that. It talks about both of these people, Henry and Adams, being elected to the first Continental Congress. And they went there, and then they were also so it says some of the things. I just want to give you some of the things that happened there. In the first one, Adams promoted colonial unity. He was trying to organize the people while they were there, and he lobbied the other delegates to come together and to form a united front against this British aggression, this British abuse. And so he did. He organized a colonial boycott known as the Continental Association, and it was in November of 1774 when he served in that, and that was an extra legal legislative body, independent of British control. Of course, the British didn't like that either. And as a member of that Congress, he created the first Minuteman companies, first in the Massachusetts area, and then it kind of spread out through the rest of the colonies. So he was developing this ability to militarily resist the British incursion, the British abuse, the British dominance, and that too was very important. They had to very much respect that. So then Adams and John Hancock now became friends back in Boston, and they attended this Provisional Congress in Concord, Massachusetts. Now get this, is a good story. Before traveling to the second Congress, They wanted to attend that, and it was being held in Concord, and that was in April. And they were going to be leaving the next month, well, at the end of that month, to actually go to take the trip to get to Philadelphia for the Second Continental Congress. So the two men decided, from the people that they knew back in Boston, that it was not safe to return to Boston before leaving to go to Philadelphia. So they stayed at Hancock's childhood home in Lexington for a couple of days. And from Boston, Dr. Joseph Warren, one of the great Patriot spies in Boston, dispatched Paul Revere to warn the two that the British were on the move and might attempt to arrest them that the night of the 18th or the morning of the 19th of April. So Hancock and Adams made their escape. As they were making that escape, the first shots of the war began in Lexington and Concord. So they just made it out of there to make it to the Second Continental Congress down in Philadelphia. Soon after the battle, Gage issued a proclamation. Gage, General Gage, was a military leader of Boston. In fact, he was the military leader of all British troops in America at the time. And Gage issued a proclamation granting a general pardon to all the patriots who would lay down their arms and return to the duties of peaceable subjects, with the exceptions of John Hancock and Sam Adams. So they get to the Second Continental Congress, and they worked under a secrecy rule. So many of the things, Adams' precise roles in that congressional deliberation, is not fully documented today. But it appears that he had a major influence working behind the scenes as sort of a parliamentary whip. And Thomas Jefferson credits Samuel Adams with steering the Congress toward independence, saying, I quote, "If there was any guide to the Revolution, Sam Adams was the man. He served on numerous committees, often dealing with military matters." And among the noted acts that Adams did that was actually recorded was Samuel Adams nominated George Washington to be the commander-in-chief over the Continental Army.
Wow. Ben Martin, we are out of time on this podcast. I think that we need to schedule another one because we still haven't really gotten to Patrick Henry yet, and we really need to do that. So let's go ahead.
Yes, we do. I apologize. Okay. It's just there really is so much about Sam Adams that's not known and all the things he did. And he just kept on going, Kim. I mean, he went through that. He went through the war doing the same things. And then after the war, he helped to write. He was one of the main guys that wrote the Articles of Confederation. And then he worked with the people on the Constitution. And then he went back to his state, retired from federal politics, from national politics, and he came back and he became governor. He became a political leader again back in his home state and eventually became governor. He served all the way up until almost the end of his life, serving the people, even when he was no longer in official capacity. So he just did a whole lot for our country that we really need to recognize. And it was a long life of service that resulted in some great things for us today.
Well, indeed, Ben Martin, we stand on the shoulders of giants. And we'll get another podcast scheduled on this. This is Kim Munson, sounding off with Kim Munson, talking with patriotic historian and former Army Ranger Ben Martin. Thank you so much, Ben, and God bless each of you listeners, and God bless America.